How's that level?
Let's one, see. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You know, I really like doing this. Da 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 da. You know,
you're
just
good.
10 times. Think. Okay.
Very good. I might be a tad high, only when you make me laugh.
Only when I make you laugh. Yeah, we may get loud. So yeah.
By the way,
think about that.
I'm gonna get our other interview up. I think over the weekend it was great.
Okay.
Thank you. People are gonna love it.
It was fun.
So, yeah. When you're ready, sir.
Okay. Of course, I actually can listen to what I said. Okay. It's Kwanzaa Hall at Sidewalk Radio.
Kwanzaa.
Yes.
Council member, District 2, Kwanzaa Hall, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
And you rode your bike over.
Yes. I'm a little out of breath. You can't quite hear it, but I did ride all the way from basically City Hall. City Hall to here. Actually, I rode from my home over in 044 by the water tower near Surface down to Georgia Tech at Spring Street, and then we rode back to City Hall and back here.
So you did a little tour of your own district.
Yeah, I did a little bit more of a ride than I expected today.
Let's tell people.
I got the cardio in.
and very composed.
You know what? It's not that bad. You know, it's not as bad as I thought, but the hills can get you.
I loved Atlanta Streets Alive, by the way.
Oh, that was phenomenal. I think we had 20,000 people out there. 20,000 people.
We talked a little bit about this at Flux, but because you were so kind to do our live interview. But I'm proud of Atlanta. I know you are.
Yeah, I think we're on the right track. Things are going in the right direction. We need some more things to catalyze. We probably need to get a little bit of religion or get some revelations that allow us to have greater revolutions in our city to turn some things upside down. I think it's a nationwide challenge that America is facing. We've got to figure a way to, you know, build some new paradigms based on things that are totally different from the way we've been doing things probably for the last 50 or so years. And if you go back, we did a lot of things a different way, and now we're in another place and we've got to get back to basics, so to speak.
Right. And that's what we're here to talk about today. On a focused approach, the paradigm of Boulevard.
Yes.
Let's, if you would, let the listener know about District 2 and where Boulevard fits into that and how it fits in.
Sure. Well, the Council District 2 is the heart of Atlanta. It goes on the south from the northern portion of Castleberry Hill, right at the intersection of Fair, Peters, and Walker, north. Including the City Hall and the Capitol Building, down 7585 Decatur Street, along the southern side Decatur Street, out to Emmett Park by Moreland, then Moreland over to Ponce de Leon back west to Piedmont north to 10th Street, and 10th Street over to West Peace Street all the way up to 18th by SCAD, and then back down into Atlantic Station, 17th Street, over to State Street, back down Marietta Street, North Side Marietta Street, and back to Castleberry, including the Phillips Arena, CNN, and all of that. So it includes, you know, Castleberry, downtown, Emmett Park, Ponce Highlands, 044.
And we are in Midtown, right here.
Midtown. Georgia Tech, Georgia State, SCAD, Marietta Street Artery. And so it's a really dynamic and diverse part of town.
Well, you know what? To say that this district encompasses education and creativity and the arts and affluency and connectivity would be a tremendous understatement. But there's this one part.
Yes, and you're right on. There, you know, everything is pretty much developed in the city, or it's on in the district, or it's on its way, with the exception of one, you know, anomaly, and that would be the Bedford Pines community along Boulevard, basically from Ponce de Leon on the north, and we just go to Freedom Parkway for an easy landmark. That area, and then over, you could go as far, if you wanted to, over to Piedmont, if you wanted to include Peachtree and Pine in that, and the parks in between, and the Civic Center, and as far east, technically, you could go all the way to the Beltline, or you could stop at Glen Iris. And so that's kind of the general bounds of the area, that portion of the Old Fourth Ward, just north of the M.L. King District, just west of the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library and Freedom Park, just south of Virginia Highlands, just south of Ponce Highlands, west and of Inman Park. So it's kind of a very dynamic, and Midtown. So it abuts these great neighborhoods that have already evolved and developed, but it is a place that is the lowest point in Council District 2. And it actually is probably one of the lowest points in the southeast when you look at the demographics of the community. And it's not because it's a predominantly African-American community, but the numbers in terms of educational attainment, in terms of income, and you know what people are paying for rent, it pretty much mirrors a public housing project in that regard, but it's privately owned. It's privately owned property called Bedford Pines, and it's been owned by Wingate Management for well over 20 years. They're a group out of Massachusetts, out of the Northeast. They own about 14,000 units around the country. Not all are low income, but they do have contracts with the federal government to do what's called place-based Section 8 housing.
Well, is this
project-based Section
8 housing?
Is this
a neighborhood or a section of a neighborhood that Atlanta has forgotten, or is this more of a private problem?
I think it's really it touches every level of government and every aspect of community here in Atlanta, but really it has implications for the broader nation, and I'll tell you why. First, there are federal guidelines, federal policies that are under the control of Congress. Well, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Congress, and the President that, you know, dictate where housing occurs, how it occurs, and what the guidelines are for the housing. So the contract that Wingate Management has with the federal government has been in place for many, many years. So they're locked into a certain agreement. Even some things they've tried to change for the better have been struck down. Okay, over various administrations. So it's not about one presidential administration or even one Congress. It's just been dealing with the bureaucracy of this giant entity. Then there are state guidelines that they also work within. There are a few city guidelines, but primarily they're private when it comes to the city interaction. But it's such a large place that it's almost now, because we don't have public housing in Atlanta like we used to. The level is much smaller, probably 10% of what we used to have. It is the place of last resort. So when people, young people especially, don't have a place to go, young mothers in particular, or folks who are not able to stay in Section 8 houses, single-family houses, they have this as a last resort. So the income on average, let me give you some of the demographics.
Let me ask you quick question. You're a politician, but you're a steward, a true steward of the community, and you're a real part of the community. I mean, you're out and you have a lot of friends and you support a lot in the arts and culture. And but your job, you know, is as councilman. And I'm wondering, and this is a feel-good show, by the way, but like, is everyone has frustrations with their job. Is your frustration with the fact that it is locked into this system that even when people want to do something good, it's hard to make it happen?
Well, actually, I'm no longer as frustrated as I'm optimistic about the great opportunity that we have. Now, it's almost like it'd be more like looking at a cup that was 95% empty, and now we see it as 5% full, okay? But the 5% and the next 1% keep coming. It came, you know, it was hard to get it started, but now we've added another 1%. This 1%, you could say we just had an announcement from the Atlanta Regional Commission. We got $1 million to do a streetscape project.
That's amazing.
And although we lost the T-splots, there was a silver lining for the Boulevard Corridor for Old Fourth Ward for in-town Atlanta to see that part of town spruced up. There's so many people right down that street. It's going to bring new life and new energy that I think will catalyze people to see their own community differently, those who live in Bedford Pines and those who ride through, to look at it in a different way. So I think now we really have to just say, you know, either we're going to lead or we're going to sit around complaining. So we're past the complaining stage or ignoring. And I'll say honestly, for the first 5 years of being on council, and if we want to go way back to being even a school board member, I focused on the families there for a couple of years back in 2002, 3, and 4, ran for city council. And in 2005, you know, the groups that, you know, squeak the loudest tend to get the oil. Whether they supported you or not, you just kind of gravitate towards who screams the most. And those are the neighborhoods that are well-heeled communities. They have attorneys that they can hire for their neighborhood associations. They are financed. You know, they have free time in the day. They don't have to work two or three jobs. They're retirees. They're well-educated. They're connected. They have former elected officials who live in their neighborhood strategizing with them, from Congress people to former council members to former mayors. So they're in a different place, and they could ask for the things that they needed for their community or wanted for their community. And, you know, Bedford Pines and the Boulevard Corridor and the families and children who live there didn't really know, first, that there were things for them, secondly, that they could ask for it, and thirdly, that they might actually get it. So, you know, we spent a lot of our time in my first couple of years just kind of putting out fires and solving problems for people no matter where they came from. And we got to a point where we'd done a lot of things for Emmett Park. We'd done a lot of things for Castleberry and for Midtown and for Georgia Tech and Georgia State and for Marietta Street and for Ponce Highlands and for downtown. But, you know, downtown proper as a small neighborhood. But, you know, and we focused intentionally on Old Fourth Ward because it still was considered kind of the lowest point. But within Old Fourth Ward, there's a lot of great energy. But still the most stagnant place was Bedford Pines in the Boulevard Corridor. So we had kind of done everything but that. And it all, we were sitting around earlier at the end of last year, my chief of staff and I, we were kind of like, well, what else is there to do? And then we're looking at each other, but there's this gigantic, ginormous, as some people say, elephant in the room, and it's looking dead smack in our face, and it's called Bedford Pines and Boulevard. So what are y'all going to do to help families and children who don't know how to ask for help?
And that's where Year Boulevard came?
Exactly. That's how we got to Year Boulevard, because Emmett Park knows how to ask. Old Fourth Ward proper knows how to ask. Castleberry knows how to ask. Downtown has CAP. Midtown has Midtown Alliance. I mean, you know, Marietta Street has their own thing. Georgia Tech knows how to ask. Georgia State knows how to ask. GAD knows how to ask. Everybody else, you know, we developers know how to ask. But, you know, they don't know first who to ask for. I mean, still to this day, they're wondering who Kwanzaa Hall is. Initially, people thought it was a building. You know, now the families and children sometimes say, Kwanzaa Hall, is that a religion? You know, so we're first having to just educate and inform and communicate to our families and children in the neighborhood, one, that we are here for them and we're a resource. It's definitely not all my responsibility.
Were you met with skepticism?
Absolutely. Still to this day, we're still working on the opportunity that exists here. Is, you know, one that, you know, there was a project here in Atlanta that President Carter, former President Carter, worked on called the Atlanta Project. And this is kind of place-based. It was the entire place of Atlanta to revitalize and lift up the families and children who are at the lowest point. Well, it didn't quite get off the ground. It was successful in some ways, and it articulated a framework, but it was too enormous, many people would say. Now there are about three or four place-based projects, revitalization and community building efforts that are in town that are underway, and they're generally funded by big foundations to try to change communities. Was one in Whitefur community, one in, I guess, south of Peoplestown, a couple other places in town near East Lake. But this one didn't have that benefactor. We didn't have that big, you know, foundation saying we're going to put $5 million or $20 million behind this effort and push it forward. We're not within any downtown or midtown improvement districts. We're just on the other side, kind of in the Beltline overlay, but not at the Beltline. We're not on Peachtree Street. So it's kind of like no man's land. And so we had to say, you know what, part of the solution. And then here's a big pushback that we got from the community. You know, the community over the years, whether it be when I moved in and I was one of these voices early on, or when I became a school board member, or when I got to be a city council member, why don't y'all just, you know, revitalize it, redevelop it, gentrify it, tear it down, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And those all sound like logical ideas, you know. Make it like, you know, Centennial Place right now and just move people out and tear that stuff down. Sounds easy, okay? Well, first, they have a contract with the federal government. Secondly, they push back on me. They say, Kwanzaa, this is Wingate Management, Kwanzaa. So if we tear it down and we just redevelop it and make it high-end units, we know people would buy them, and we make a lot of money now, but we can make even more. But where would the people go? Where would they go, Kwanzaa? And I was like, guys, you're right. You got a good point. So if we're not going to move people out, and I agree with that, I think we don't need to displace people. We need to follow the same models of the Historic District Development Corporation, which was founded by Coretta Scott King, revitalize the area around Dr. King's birth home, but empower people to do that themselves.
Right.
Okay. Well, so let me just finish this little piece. Sure. On the Bedford Pines piece, so what we said, okay, we've got to kind of have a two-pronged approach. We've got to get the community around Bedford Pines, which is developed and evolving, to embrace the fact that if you help to lift up Bedford Pines with your time and energy and resources, it only makes your quality of life increase. One. Two, we've got to get inside of Bedford Pines, touch the children first, touch the young mother second, and touch the property owners and the seniors to empower them to own their own futures and be a part and stakeholders in their lives when they have not been educated or taught how to do that in many cases. There's no book for a young mother who's 15 and she was at home for a couple of years and now she's 18 and her parents tell her she has to leave. She has two kids and she hadn't graduated and she's trying to get a GED, but she can't quite work and do GED and take care of her kids. So she has to be on public assistance. So her income is basically like $3,000 a year, and her rent is $12 a month. If she makes more money, which obviously people do strive to do that, she's kicked out of that rent structure, so she has to pay $500 a month. And do the math. If you're still only making $6,000 or even $10,000, even $15,000, and you're paying $500 a month or more in rent, and we know what rent is around here, even you got roommates, and if you have roommates, it could be problems. Who wants to be your roommates? Not like you're a college student. You got two kids. They need their own little rooms. I mean, privacy, all those kind of issues. And you want to be near a good school or you want to be near the bus line. We know we don't have transportation network. So we're starting to discover that everything is designed wrong for this community success. And last thing, and I'll turn it back to you. When I sat with the owners of Wingate Management and I said, guys, so, but let me challenge you. You're right. Where do the people go? But I said, in the last 20 years, can you count on your hands or can you tell me that you have a record and know how many children graduated from high school? Take it a step further. Do you know how many children went to college? Out of 700 units, maybe 3,000 people. Can you tell me you know of 10 success stories? Can you tell me you know of 5 success stories? Because you should know them every year. You should know those 5 out of 700, though. And let's just say, do these kids even graduate? So they were like, Kwanzaa, you know what? And I said, guys, let me challenge you even more. Can you really say in your heart of hearts that this is the kind of community you grew up in? And even more importantly, now it's not your responsibility to take care of people. Your job is to house them. But can you really say that you feel good knowing that you have just allowed 2 and 3 generations of families to just stay here? That's all they do.
Do they have any type of contractual obligation to help improve at least their facility?
They do have an agreement with HUD to do a certain level of renovation and repair, and they have actually committed. I mean, and I'm telling you kind of the conversations, and I'll tell you what they're doing now. That was 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, but there are requirements to do a certain level of repair, but it's not like your apartment is repaired.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Right. Well, let me give a little bit of a nod to what I see as a success, because I've been here for 17 years and I've been an in-town guy the whole time. And I remember going to neighborhood meetings and, you know, one of the first things that happens in a neighborhood meeting, police report. And the sergeant, you know, talking about this area was like, do not stop and fill your car up with gas at that BP. Mm-hmm. This is one of the most dangerous places in the city. And people are speeding down there. It's a problem for the pedestrians. It's a problem for the people speeding. But it looked really bad, too.
Mm-hmm.
I subscribe to the broken window theory. It's more than just a broken window. It's crime. It's vandalism. If you fix that window and then go beyond that and fix every window in the building and then every window on the block, people start behaving better. Things start looking up. And you all, through Euro Boulevard, put trash cans out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that might sound like something very simple, but I was driving down Boulevard last night on the way to an event at the Atlanta Preservation Center and looking, and where there's a trash can, there is no trash. Where there's not a trash can, there's trash. So it's nice to be able to see the difference, because I think a lot of times we hear all these big plans and aspirations, and we even might even know at some point what needs to be done to fix the problem, but it's out there. It's kind of in the ether.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know from you, like, what other things can we expect to see physically in the way of improvement, and what do you think that will do for the community and also the residents of that community?
Well, and I really do appreciate your observation. And like yourself, those of us who live in the community and have been driving through, we can see the slightest changes. You know, you can see, you know, the lights are on, you know, oh, wait a minute, they just cleaned up the corner. So, you know, you can feel the difference because you look at it every day and other people don't know. They think, oh, it's still blighted. But we've been watching this little bit of change happen. And I'll tell you honestly, after we started, and we did kind of what I would say is our first community, real community cleanup back in 2007 or so, but six or so. But for really focusing on Bedford Pines, we started back this summer. And I think the community cleanup process brings everybody together. It's a level playing field, and you all just chip in to make your community better. And I think that is one of the tools that we're kind of using to bring people together across lines and focus on just making it look nicer. Because when you take pride in where you are, you begin to act differently. So that cleanliness piece really does matter. We're taking additional steps along those lines. Now, Wingate Management, they initially, so going back to the point about, you know, hey, well, what are y'all going to do? They said, well, we'll chip in. TEDx Atlanta asked me, Kwanzaa, what if you had one wish, what would you like? I said, summer possibility for every child in the community. And they said, sure. And Wingate said, okay, we'll chip in $15,000 and we'll help make it work. Da 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 da. We got kids in four summer programs. We tried to target all 700 of the kids who lived in the community who were able to go to camp. We want to continue and try to really have after school on Saturday start next semester and for sure in the summer, because we know change doesn't happen overnight. We've got to commit to do this. So we called it Year Boulevard, but it's really Years of Boulevard, or as we're now saying, it's Mo Boulevard next year. So it won't be just Yo, it's, you know, more of Boulevard. But so there's kind of multiple tracks. There's, first and foremost, there's a public safety track. Secondly, there's kind of a community engagement track, and that happens, and we built a community outreach facility. Instead of taking kids to jail, you can kind of take them there and kind of, you know, mitigate risk and stuff. And then we started doing our community cleanups and focus on those. Then we're doing things specifically with children. We had a partnership. We have a great partnership with Fulton County Commissioner Joan Garner, and she helped us to bring out all the human service agencies from Fulton County, and we did a block party where we invited the parents to come out because we got their attention by helping their kids for free. And they were like, okay, so they really are serious. They're genuine. They want to help. They're not going to try to arrest us or whatever they thought. And this guy, Kwanzaa Hall, is a person, you know. So people came out on that Saturday in July. And now we're kind of taking it to another level. Wingate Management is going to invest several hundred thousand dollars in just sprucing up the outside. They help pay for the banners that you see on Boulevard. So we've got kind of a running train of these little things that add up to big momentum.
Yeah, you incremental.
Know? Well, yes, incremental.
You know, I mean, look, I'm a fan of yours, and I like you a lot and being around you. This show is not, you know, meant to give just props and kudos to Kwanzaa, though. But I do think that it's certainly noteworthy to talk about you and your role here. You're young, and it seems to me like you're doing politics and service in a different way. And I mean that relating back to what you said, TEDx.
Mm-hmm.
TEDx is a smart program. You know, there's conversations kind of like the one we're having that are educational, but not only did you work with them, but you also got Radcliffe Bailey, who's one of the most celebrated artists certainly in the country, internationally even, and, you know, a local, art hero here. And you got him involved. I mean, how is that just because that's the way you are? You're young and creative, or did you see this like as a need that needed to be put into action?
Well, I think it's a combination. When you're, I honestly believe God gives us everything we need. Okay, and we just have to figure out what are the things that we have, whether it be relationships or resources or ideas or brain power, willpower. How do we need to organize those things to get there? Now, for instance, my relationship with Radcliffe really goes back to his mother. His mother was my first grade teacher. And I hadn't seen her in years at Venetian Hills Elementary School here in Atlanta. So we grew up, and he and I were in art class together. So
how'd you do in art?
That's where the prettiest girls were. I was a freshman, and I saw the art. I was like, what class is that? And they were like, that's art. I want to be in that class. And those are all the senior girls, 11th graders, 12th graders. So I had to be in art for like 3 years. it was the best class ever, Mr. Butler's class. But Radcliffe was in there, and many other notable artists kind of went through that network, whether they are over at, I guess, Art Institute and AIU. So, we just kind of hung out. I was more on the graffiti side, breakdancer, graffiti guy. So, but still, just being in a creative space helped me to grow as a person. So I think creativity is one of the hallmarks of helping young people and helping communities grow. There's been a ton of studies and work out there by Richard Florida and many other people about, the creative class and building, innovation centers. We just had a talk today from Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institute at the Atlanta Regional Commission breakfast. And he talked about how Atlanta, the metro area, has all the right bones to focus on innovation. And really, and of all places, Old Fourth Ward and everything around Bedford Pines makes that up. Whether you talk about colleges, you talk about, three hospitals, Atlanta Medical Center, Grady, Emory. You talk about the types of folks like yourself and myself and all our friends who are designing bikes, designing things for Etsy to, on radio, doing everything you can think of. They have a regular job and three other things they have brewing at home or with a partner, Scout Mob, Groupon. All the folks who are just creating the future for us. We need to create places where they can be a part. Now, what could be really unique, because places like Bedford Pines exist around this country, this urban core. Could we actually figure out how to empower people in the urban core to participate in the global economy in a way that is freeing of whether you have a college degree or not? So can you design your own iPhone apps? Can you, if you're a 15-year-old, we know they know more about phones than most people do. It's surely more than their parents or their grandparents who want to learn how to set the phone up. Can they repair the phones and have their own little business? I think we've got to just break the paradigm and say, wait a minute, y'all, this stuff ain't working. What do people want to know? They want to know about studio equipment. They want to know about, movie maker. They do know.
My little brother, Roderick Redman, and Big Brothers Big Sisters, we've been matched up for 12 years now. I'm on the board of directors there, so I've seen a lot beyond our personal relationship. But when we go out and do things together, yeah, he likes to go to the Falcons, even though I'm a Saints fan. It's tough on me, but
sorry,
that's all right.
Sorry, man. I won't hold
y'all
that
are doing
you.
Great.
I was liking you. Bring me some beignets when we beat y'all again.
But, what he liked the most was just driving around with me, looking at real estate, talking about the things that I'm doing. He just never had the exposure, like you're saying, to that. So how do you get these kids who are in Bedford Pines exposed to this in a safe way, and beyond just exposing it, can have a continuing type of education for them?
Exactly. So that's what we've been working on as kind of the next iteration of Yo Boulevard or Mo Boulevard. We want to be able to, one, make sure there's an educational continuum in the community, so young people not only go to school, but they have after school, Saturday, and summer enrichment, and that's locked in. We're only talking about a finite area of, a couple of blocks and 700 families. So we're not talking about 7,000, only 700 families. Some already have some type of resource, but we need to provide more. Then we start pairing off those who want to go the technology route, those who want to go the create more pure creative route, and those who want to go kind of entrepreneurship, whether it be real estate and things like that. And folks like us begin to plug in through structured programs. We bring people in from the music industry, all these folks who are making films here. You know, we, for the last 2 years or 3 years, we've been taking young people behind, from Boulevard, from Operation Peach, which is one of the after-school programs, behind the scenes at the BET Hip Hop Awards. And we have artists that come out. Last year it was Ludacris. This year it was T.I. And they get to watch them perform and prepare. But they also get to go behind the scenes and talk to the 200 different people who have other jobs that you can do. You know,
which is cool.
The grips, you know, the mic guys. I mean, the folks who do just making sure travel works for thousands of people to get there to this award and get the company moving over the course of a year. So they're like, wow, we can do more than just, you know, just be the rapper or just be the basketball player. And speaking of basketball, you know, we just got a grant from Atlanta Hawks. I think they've given us the largest grant they've ever given, $50,000 to build what will be the largest set of courts in the city of Atlanta. And they're redoing it at Central Park, which is just two blocks from Boulevard. So I think, you know, also momentum comes, and folks generally in Atlanta have been given the things that they don't really see a great return. But if we have a good plan and we have positive momentum and we just get a little bit from everybody, we can make a phenomenal stone soup, so to speak.
Tell us about you as a kid growing up here.
Well, you know, I grew up in Southwest Atlanta, went to Atlanta Public Schools. My parents worked in civil rights. My dad was the youngest member of Dr. King's staff. He was from Montgomery, Alabama, got kicked out of school at 17 and came to Atlanta with Dr. King and lived right in the old Fourth Ward. At the time when I moved there, I didn't know it. But my mother and family members said, yeah, your dad lived right at the top of the hill by the Freedom Park Bridge at Glen Iris at Randolph Street. But, you know, so I think, and my mother was from Chicago, and she was working in Chicago doing organizing there. And they got together. And
how did they get into that?
You know, I think it was my dad, you know, grew up in the church in Alabama. And I think, you know, when you look back at the history of how the civil rights movement evolved, the young people were truly the fuel and pretty much for all revolutions, you know, if you want to call that a mini kind of revolution. It wasn't violent per se that they were doing violence, but people were doing violence to them. But young people were the folks who left school and were willing to walk in the streets, because when you're young, you have courage. When you're old, you have responsibilities and you become a capitalist and you're like, wait a minute, why would I go do that? Right. So he was one of those young people who had probably 13, 14, went on one of his first sit-ins or rallies. And he caught the bug. And by the time he was 17, he was locking the doors on Alabama State University with some of his friends so that all the college students would have to leave school. Because, you know, if you lock students out of school for more than an hour, they're going to have fun. It's kind of like having a freaknik in Atlanta. Well, their idea of a freaknik was to go march to Selma. So that was kind of how they got more students to participate. You kind of get your friends to come participate. And if it's fun and it's pretty guys and pretty girls, people, you know, have a great time doing it, as in other movements throughout history. So that was kind of what he was into. And my mom was into the same thing in Chicago, and they met up in Chicago. And so growing up, my younger brother and I kind of always were around. You know, here in Atlanta, it was in housing projects. We were either between City Hall, housing projects, some social service organization like Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, NAACP, Southern Regional Council. And, you know, so there we would be with hippies, hipsters, you know, pro-black radical, and politicians and musicians all at one time in one day. We might see Frank Sinatra, who's coming to do a benefit concert for the King holiday. We might see Miss King, and then we may be with my dad's best friend who lived in a housing project, who worked in civil rights with him and was living on a fixed income, and then we'd go give food or clothes to a family. So we always were helping, you know, people in the community. And so we kind of inherited that, you know, legacy of giving back and being community people.
And you liked it, obviously.
Well, you know, sitting in the car, luckily I had my little brother, so we both would be there and we'd be fighting and talking and making jokes and stuff. But, you know, usually it was like a great day, but he'd say, kids, y'all stay in the car. Sometimes he'd take us and we'd go in, but other times he'd leave us in the car and be like, Dad, when are you coming back? But, you know, he always came back with something that got us on the hook again. So he's like, well, we're going to go here now. So we would have, you know, those kind of trips. They were kind of like adventures. And then, you know, we spent a lot of time going fishing on Saturdays. My parents got divorced when I was probably 10 or 11, 12. But my dad, he refused to move far away. So he moved probably half a mile from us, you know. So it was like, sons, I'm going to be in your life all the time. So we go fishing on weekends and just spend week, whether we caught fish or not, just being out there, being together. And, you know, so we knew we had a strong father figure in our lives, and we would take our friends with us who didn't have their fathers in our
That's
lives.
That's so important.
So, you know, he would bring them and say, bring your friends. So we'd have a carload of us, four or five of us, and my dad and maybe his best friend, and we just sit out there, tell jokes, and camp out, you know, eat sardines because we didn't catch any fish, you know, just stuff like that, you know. So it was really fun growing up here in Atlanta. You know, I never knew the idea of, you know, kind of looking down my nose at people, because we dealt with all kinds of folks, high and low. So we treated, you know, he treated everybody the same. And we're all human, and you try to help people, and everybody has some kind of shortcoming, but also everybody has something to offer us, what we learned from him. And, you know, he was such a giving person and such a loving, loving man. He really was a great person. He died at a very young age. He died at 42.
Oh my God.
So, you know, I'm 41. I turn 42 next year.
Does that give you pause for kind of some introspection?
Yeah, well, you know, I about 10 years ago, I started trying to make sure I focused on my health, you know, not working too hard and trying to rest and work out and exercise. Obviously, you've noticed I've slimmed up some, you know, trying to tone up. And, you know, I think having
tip-top shape.
Yeah, you've got to help folks, but at the same time, you've got to take care of yourself. Is what I learned and I committed to doing, watching how he just kind of gave so unselfishly. But he came out of that 60s era, and they were very idealistic. And when Dr. King passed away, you know, many of those who were committed to that dream, that's all they could see. You know, they weren't really capitalists. You know, he was 17. He was 21 when Dr. King died. You know, and Dr. King was 38. And so many of the other folks who were in the movement were much older. He was still like, yeah, let's go do it. You know, you're 30 still talking about, yeah, let's go do it. You know what I mean? So I think, you know, it took him a while to kind of get towards being a business person and kind of doing, he always worked and stuff like that, but kind of thinking capitalistic, if I had to describe it another way, being a capitalist. And if he did have good business ideas, they were way ahead of their time. He had some great ideas, but it's like he wanted to do bookstores in the African-American community. It makes sense, but it's hard to really pull off some of the ideas that you see in other communities. And he was a well-traveled man. And, you know, so he instilled a lot in our lives, and I think he touched a lot of people. So I do feel like I have a responsibility to carry on, you know, his legacy, but also the legacy of so many people who I think contributed to my life. I think back when we were growing up, we would have Kwanzaa celebrations. And back then, no one knew what Kwanzaa was. You know, it's African-American celebration that started just in the 60s. Right? And they were like, what is a Kwanzaa? They thought I was Russian when I was a kid. Right? So I'm in all-black school, but they're thinking I'm Russian. Right? So I was like, what kind of name is that? Kwanzaa-stant? And I was like, no, it's, you know, it's, and it was really difficult growing up. But when I got to be about 13,
well,
14.
Try being Eugene.
Yeah, that might be kind of hard, too. But at least they can get with it. They know what a gene is, or, you know, you or something. But they gave me a hard time, man. And so, you know, an African-American community can be tough on you when, you know, when it comes down to stuff like that. But it was okay. But, you know, when we were growing up, we would have, you know, in the black side of Atlanta, southwest Atlanta, we would have probably more white people in our house at times than black people when they had the Kwanzaa celebration. Because my dad had friends in every circle. You know, he grew up in, you know, rural Alabama, but his friends were hippies like Tom Houck. As a matter of fact, Tom Houck was at the hospital when I was born because my dad was out of town. So he and somebody else took my mom to the hospital. So it was a network of, you know, black and white, you know, gay and straight folks who just, you know, artists and creatives. They hung out with the, you know, a lot of the top entertainers of the day because they funded the civil rights movement. The Aretha Franklins, the Sammy Davis Jr.'s, the Frank Sinatra's, all of those artists were people who would, you know, lend their planes to Dr. King and allow them to kind of give them $50,000 to just continue the efforts because they weren't doing it selfishly. They were trying to make America a better place. So that kind of lifestyle is what they lived. So it was, you know, kind of like, you know, I'm in the clubs with you guys. I'm at the coolest parties. I like to hang out with the artists, but also we're trying to make a difference. So I think that piece kind of rubbed off on me as well. And I think it rubbed off on a lot of us. You know, that's how our parents are. If you look back, what our parents were doing when they were 20 and 30, and when we were growing up, it's probably how we're going to be to some degree.
Well, yeah, I hear a lot about from this discussion where you got your exposure to and influence and inspiration to connect with people, and it's really nice, and also the power of having a role model in your life, and especially as a strong parent figure. And it, when you think back to your story about, you know, a 15-year-old girl with two kids and no husband around, I mean, that's tough. And her kids, it's brutal.
Yes.
And yes. I can see why you want to help make a big difference.
Yeah.
But, like, is it, and I know you're like, yeah, the glass is now 5% full, mm-hmm. Does it get daunting? Or, you know, how do you, like, as talk to the younger listener out there, like, how do you, like, get re-inspired? How do you keep going?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think first you really have to have faith and hope and believe beyond what you can see, because you can't really see it, and it's not going to be something you can author. You kind of just have to tee things up. It's kind of like playing golf for the first time, and they tell you, just close your eyes, rear back and swing, and you'll hit it. But if you pay too much attention to anything or try to focus and act like you're going to hit it, you never hit it, right? Same thing with this. I think it's one of those things where we have to just line up, try to get all the ducks in a row. So, you know, I used to do science projects when I was growing up in high school, and they kind of kept me out of trouble. I'll say, honestly, they saved my life. And, you know, for
what type of projects?
Oh, well, I worked on plants. I love biology and botany, plant botany. And my thing was, you know, I wanted to get a patent on a plant. I wanted to work with the Tradescantia clone, which was in the spiderwort family, Wandering Jew. It changes color from blue to red when exposed to radiation. And they had planted them around nuclear reactors in Japan. And I saw this back in 95 and took that and said, well, what if we could transfer the firefly gene into this plant, have it to be repressed until exposed to radiation, then have it glow in the dark? So I wrote all these letters to different folks around the country and figured out how to get my science project going. Went to Yale one summer, won all the state science fairs. But actually, as a matter of fact, one day I got brought to school by the police because it was a snow day in Atlanta. And they thought we were trying to rob a bank because we were in a parking lot with four of our friends, and all of our people had kind of scattered, and we were left there. Police pull up behind us, and they say, well, we got a report. You guys are trying to rob a bank. We said, no, we were just on snow day, officer. And I was a 10th grader, and my friends were a little older, 11th or 12th grade. They followed us to school. The guys had been getting in a lot of trouble. I had kind of some bad friends, cool but bad friends, and they ended up going to detention or getting suspended, and, you know, and I ended up going to homeroom. So when I get to homeroom, the principal announces who won the science fair. And she was like, John Jones, Tony Johnson, Kwanzaa Hall. So it was kind of, you know, I had to make a tough decision. So even in spite of the fact that I had, you know, great parents who loved me, who supported me, it was still difficult to be on the right path. And I think that's true for all of us. We come from great families. So, you know, when you think about Bedford Pines, it's almost like we've got to, you know how you have these blended families nowadays? That's the new thing in America. Well, we got to just embrace the whole community and make them our family. That's how I see it. All 700 families there are related to me. And that's the only way to treat them. Because if people don't have love, they don't feel. If you feel loved, then you can love yourself and you can love others. And love is a very powerful thing. So we're starting with a very simple place. Just be open to we can't say we know the solution. We're just going to be open to trying to understand it first. So yeah. We're just delving in, and wherever we see a little problem and we know we can fix it, we're like, ah, we know somebody who can help us fix this. We just met with Microsoft the other day, and they said, oh, wow, Kwanzaa, we want to help you with this. I said, well, Google said they might help us, and we'd love to see Apple, but whoever wants to be here, we're gonna receive you. And so you know, you kind of just have to take one little bite at a time. They're like, well, we might have some summer jobs, or we might have a training program, or put a camp, or put kids through all the Microsoft Office package suite that they want to learn. We can do that. We have them free.
And I think it's important for, like, the people listening, and, you know, they need to go to the Yale Boulevard website to check out all the ways that they can help. But
yes.
When you help, and I know this from Big Brothers Big Sisters primarily, it makes you feel good. Makes you feel good about yourself.
It does. It does. You feel great about yourself. You kind of, like on a great day like today, after you've done something to help somebody, you can just rest assured that when you walk through the park, it's not all selfish about you. You've done something that's sustainable in terms of its impact. A lot of times people get caught up in just going to feed folks and stuff out on the street, and it seems like that's a great thing to do. But if you're just giving a man a fish, he's going to still need fish tomorrow. I mean, let's empower he and his children to be able to make their own fishing rods, to know how to, you know, get to different lakes. I mean, you know, you understand, empower people to make nets so they can eat forever and have a little business and build a school. So I think, you know, for those young people who are listening especially, I would just say, you know, continue to dream and let Atlanta be a place where you test out your dreams. Atlanta has one challenge, and I think I mentioned this on the other show. We've still got to focus on how we allow merit to reign supreme. And I think the time is coming when this city will eventually just break out of the paradigm of not allowing merit, the cream, to rise to the top. And there's so much cream in the young generation here in our city. And so y'all just need to keep dreaming and be open to putting your ideas on the table when the time is right, and just strike the iron when it's hot and watch what happens.
And
what the idea is.
What you mean by that, and I know, is it doesn't matter if you have money or don't have money.
That's right.
If you're even, you know, even if you didn't graduate from high school, if you graduated from an MIT.
That's right.
If you have a good idea and you want to help the community, let it shine.
That's right. Go ahead and let your light shine. There's a song called This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine. That's what everybody needs to do, because everyone has been blessed with some talent or skill or excellence in a field of some sort. And they just need to be willing to let other folks know that you can do this and provide that value to the global market space. And if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door.
How about some of the lights that have shone from that Bedford Pine community that you can tell us about?
Oh, wow. Well, we did have a young lady who came back, who had gone through the after-school program, and now she's at Spelman, actually two of them. So that was success, and we really want to highlight them and keep them engaged. Great stories. One of the interviewers from Channel 2, one of the cameramen, actually grew up in Bedford Pines. He and his wife grew up in the neighborhood. And he was just doing the interview, and he said, well, I grew up around the corner. I was like, man, you know what? As soon as we can, we want to have you to come back and tell these young people about your story and inspire them to do like you did. That's all they need to do is see it and know it, that you lived in unit 234 and they can live in unit 237 and do the same thing. That's all people need to know, is that it's possible. And once people see that it's possible, oh, they will strike out and do it. But they need to know, you know, they need to be inspired. So I think that's kind of, that's another light. I think this new conversation with Microsoft is really encouraging. The $1 million from ARC to do Hardscape. But I think most of the lights to me are really around building people, because Atlanta knows how to do infrastructure. We know how to build buildings. We know how to tear things down. We know how to tear down stadiums, build new stadiums. We can do that well. But we have not mastered building our people. You go to places like Asheville, you go to Raleigh, Durham, you go to Research Triangle, you go to Silicon Valley. I mean, and you see, you know, just a whole confluence of folks who are supporting each other. North Carolina is on fire as a state in terms of educating and lifting up the least of those in their state. No matter if they're hillbillies, or no matter if they're, you know, African Americans in the urban community, they're supporting everybody to bring them forward. And that's what we need to do here in this state in a way that we've never done it before.
Well, I agree. And I think that you see these micro success stories like Atlanta Streets Alive. I think you see that and you positively reinforce it through this programming. And a great one that I know you're involved with is with Living Well.
Yes, Truly Living Well. Yes,
Rashid Nuri. I mean, tell us about that. And also, I'd love to hear your personal, like, you know, interest in it through your interest in botany?
Yeah, well, you know, a couple of things. Well, first, we had four summer programs to happen in the community. Two were already in existence. One was at the city site at Central Park, which was basketball and lacrosse. Great thing, Jim Brown actually got medals for lacrosse. So we wanted to let African Americans know this is a great way to go to college if you learn how to play lacrosse, one other avenue to college. But we had two new ones. One was the Children's Defense Fund Freedom School, phenomenal program with national and international acclaim and awards for the great work they're doing around the country. They take primarily urban youth who are in college and have them to come back and teach youth in urban communities just like the ones they grew up in or they live in. And there are 90 sites. We had never had one in Atlanta, but there are more African-American college students here in Atlanta than anywhere else in the country. And they were like, Kwanzaa, what's up with this? Why haven't y'all figured this out? So I was meeting with Mary and Ryan Edelman.
Which, by the way, I mean, that says a lot. And it was a huge reason why the civil rights movement was so strong here. And, well, you know, home here.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So we need to use that talent. Yeah. Continue. It's a great asset that we've got to use and not be so caught up in the bling and the Bentleys, but put some energy back into the young people in the community. So so Children's Defense Fund, we got that kicked off in partnership with Mayor Reed and Parks and Recreation Department. So we got that reading program at the ML King Center. And then lastly, but probably most exciting of all the programs was the partnership with Truly Living Well, which is an urban farm on the former site of Wheat Street Gardens. And Rashid Nouri, he is the leader of this effort. And we've basically just taken fallow land in the core of Atlanta. It's up to potentially 8 acres. It's about 4 acres under production right now. Working farm. It's been in existence for about 2 years. We have support from Arthur Blank's Family Foundation, from the Atlanta Falcons, from the EPA, the Wheat Street Charitable Foundation. And the whole thing about this project is that, you know, it's teaching, training, bringing community together across lines, across demographics. Everybody wants to come and taste the food and be a part of, get their hands in the dirt. They take EBT and WIC payments, so you can, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you make.
We could go there right now and we could buy produce, right?
There's produce on sale right now from 3 to 7 every Friday, and on Wednesdays out at the other side of Washington Road. Food is great, always, you know, fresh, and I mean, they even have cooks on site to do demonstrations for raw food and things like that. But you know, for me, I grew up here in Atlanta, but my grandparents all had gardens, at least a quarter acre for one of my grandfathers. My other family in Montgomery in Alabama had farms and stuff. So we always went to the country and played around in the garden and stuff. But I had a special passion for plants and trying to, you know, bring plants together, grow fruit trees and cross-pollinate things. And, you know, so when Rashid and I met maybe 6-7 years ago, he needed a site, and I was thinking of a small site, you know, maybe just a former vacant lot that a home was on. He's like, no, Kwanzaa, I need more than that. And so we kept looking and kept looking and kept looking and kept looking. And finally, when we demolished Wheat Street Gardens, which was the place where my dad's best friend lived, it was low-income housing, the first faith-based low-income housing development in the country, built back in the late 50s and 60s, by William Holmes Borders, who was the Reverend Lisa Borders' great-grandfather. He was a reverend at Wheat Street Church. But this site is where Lester Hankinson lived. Big Lester was his name. He actually got stabbed in the stomach or with a bayonet protecting Dr. King. And, you know, he was living on a fixed income with his family. But my dad would take us over there on weekends. And we'd, you know, bring him some food or bring some money or something like that. And, you know, we'd go fishing with him. And, you know, that was where we went. So we always had this wonderful view of downtown sitting right in his apartment. So we sit up on the porch and look out on downtown. So one day when I was sitting over there with Rashid, it kind of dawned on me like, dang, you know, you always go where your friends are, but to actually be, you know, working in a garden and sitting there, like today would be great to go sit over, and I may ride my bike back over there and just kind of hang out for a minute. But just to sit there, reflect on downtown, but reflect on how a full life cycle has kind of happened, and now I'm back on this site, and we're regenerating it, and we're doing something special to bring family and children together in the same spirit of Big Lester, my dad, Leon Hall. You know, in just a block or two from the where Dr. King's office is, from where Dr. King and Coretta Scott King are buried and where they preached, and just kind of to see all of this stuff, the confluence of it, and now it's building community, you know, and making that beloved community that Dr. King spoke about, because it's a very diverse group of people who hang out there, who work there, who come and buy their produce there, who just are surprised that it exists. We've had the, you know, Gary Black, who's Republican Agriculture Commissioner out there, and he loves the site. We've had Congressman John Lewis. We have chickens on the site because we know Congressman Lewis loves chickens. And when he was growing up, he used to preach to the chickens. And we have honeybees. I mean, you know, we have fish out there. I mean, so it's just it's turned into something that it's an oasis in the city. And that was a great place for young people who live just a few blocks from there, who live in Bedford Pines, to get a chance to come in and touch nature and touch life and be a part of planning and growing and of all,
and to forget about life for a minute.
Yes, escape. And we can even go there and do that right now.
Well, I had the, I went with you one afternoon, and now it's all making sense because we were walking down the rows, and you're like, I don't think that pepper's ready yet. I'm like, how does he know? But it was so cool, and I loved it. But it's that, and to me, it's that programming, right? It's like, be it the Streets Alive, be it the summer programs that you do, be it like working in the garden or even just going to buy produce together, having the activity where everyone can do it and letting the merit shine,
mm-hmm.
not like how much money you have or what you're driving or mm-hmm. where you were educated or in any of that, I think is really key.
Mm-hmm. Doing something great doing something well so that it becomes great for others and not just yourself. And I think there's a lot of opportunities to do that just on this platform with the O Boulevard and what we're doing in O 4th Ward. And what we really pray is that this will become multiple modules and models that people can use in neighborhoods here in Atlanta, my colleagues can use, or around the country, around the world.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. Let's kind of conclude with a call to action, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Well, we're in the next phase of your boulevard, and we're really asking people to come out for our community cleanup. It's coming up in a couple of weeks. It's October, and we want you to go to the website, sign up for your boulevard. We can send you emails and just kind of, one, get bodies out there on the street. We just need, you know, every new person that participates makes the time that we have to spend cleaning up drop by a minute or two. So when you get over about 300 people, if you can get to about 500, I mean, literally in 2 hours, we could probably clean the entire street, because we're also going to have City of Atlanta workers and, you know, corrections workers. But we need those extra bodies out there just for 2 hours to help us clean up. And it's going to be phenomenal.
Can we get some music?
We'll have some music. You want to bring it or we want us to bring it? We'll have DJs out there. We'll bring your headphones too, your iPod. You can whistle while you work, whatever you need to do, because it is a long street. So we're kind of not just on Boulevard, but we're on Parkway and some of the side streets that cross Boulevard. But that's really our next big call to action. But make sure you sign up on the website. And then longer term, we're still trying to make sure we get the young people in enrichment programs for a continuum, so we can track progress. We really want to tie metrics to what we're doing. So we do need additional funds. And it's a 501c3 that's been supported by the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. We'll eventually probably port it over to United Way as we can get some support there. It's not, I don't work for this entity. It's not going to my pocket or anybody I know. This is strictly directly. We don't have overhead. We don't have staff. It's going directly to the efforts that we're working on. So it's kind of a direct shot, and that's great that we don't have to carry any overlay. We're kind of just doing it out of the District 2 office until we're to a place where we can, acting as a convener, but we can eventually add a little more structure, but we want to keep it lean so they can actually just be about changing people's lives.
Well, you're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Thank you for giving us a voice, too.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate your work, man.
Very well.
Thanks.